Agile for Humans is brought to you by Audible.com. Get one free audiobook and a 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/agile. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player, including Scrum, The Art of Doing Twice the Work in Half the Time by Jeff Sutherland, and Crucial Conversations by Kerry Patterson. Visit www.audibletrial.com/agile to enjoy your free audiobook today.
Processes and tools dominate today's Agile discussions, but we are devoted to the individuals and interactions that make it work. From the beginner to the veteran practitioner, we have something for you. Welcome to Agile for Humans.
All right, welcome to this week's episode of Agile for Humans. I'm your host, Ryan Ripley. Joining me today, a good friend from across the pond, Mr. Neil Killick. Neil, how are you, sir?
I'm very good, thank you, Ryan. Pleasure to be here.
You know, Neil gave me that nudge I needed to get back on the microphone. Many of the listeners are probably aware. It's probably been a month and a half since a new episode's come out. A lot going on in real life makes it hard to jump online sometimes. But Neil, thanks for the nudge. I've been looking forward to this ever since you reached out.
No problem. Yeah, I've just been listening to the show incessantly over the past few days in the car, and it just made me realize what a good time I had on the show previously, and such great conversations, and the way that you host with a real impartial approach is really, really quite impressive. So yeah, just very keen to have another conversation.
Yeah, so no pressure, right? I guess I better do good on this one. We will put the host skills. My skills are now being put to the test. We'll see how it goes.
Well, I'm pretty sure you're going to rise to the occasion.
Very good. So Neil, of course, people know you from the No Estimates conversation, from the management conversation. You know, you and I have talked a little bit about how we're kind of those unique people in the Agile community who actually have management responsibilities along with coaching responsibilities, and that stuff gets interesting. A topic that comes up when you're managing people and when you're also trying to coach them is this whole conception of Shuhari. And I know from Twitter and some other conversations recently, you've really been hammering some ideas there. When it comes to Shuhari, what's the interest level lately in that? What are you seeing in the community, and how are you applying that to your practice?
It's a concept that I guess I've known about for a few years, and I suppose I've never really thought too much about it. And then there was probably two or three years ago, there was a few things being tweeted about Shuhari, and I just found myself reacting quite negatively to it. And I think sometimes the way the concept is presented is a little bit, how I said it at the time anyway, feels a little bit patronizing to, very seasoned professionals in their craft. We sometimes talk a little bit as if, you know, software professionals, software developers are these kind of people who haven't got a clue how to work together and, you know, what processes to use, and that they need this kind of shoe level teaching, you know, to follow the rules and basically sort of, take a well-defined practice and process and just run with it in order to sort of develop into the next stage where you can kind of start questioning the rules a little bit. And the thing is, there's nothing wrong with the concept at all. Because, you know, Alistair Coburn, we just recently had Alistair in my company. He spent a day with us talking about the heart of Agile. And, you know, Shuhari is something that he talks about, and it makes a lot of sense in terms of it's, you know, representing the stages of learning we go through with any particular new skill. And I completely subscribe to that. But then someone tweeted the other day, and they actually wrote a bit of a blog post about this and about how it's actually, given that most of the time Agile is pretty much imposed on people in organizations, and, teams aren't actually choosing to do Scrum or to do Agile, and therefore it doesn't really apply to say that these people are at shoe level, because when you're at shoe level in a martial art, for example, – you're actually choosing to be in the dojo with your master. You know, you're submitting to them and to their mastery of what they're doing, and you're saying, hey, I'm here to follow the rules and to really learn the basics. But that's not the case in agile software development teams. So it's just an interesting one. So it's kind of, I've got kind of gone up and down on the topic. I definitely subscribe to the fact that it's an interesting model to apply to stages of learning. I just wonder about it, like how useful it is when we talk about it in a sort of agile context, when we're trying to, I guess we're trying to win over people in terms of the benefits of agile. And, we want people to get the benefits of it because we know how much, I suppose, joy and effectiveness it's brought to our lives. And I feel like sometimes we kind of baby people a little bit in the way that we present ideas. So that's kind of, a bit of a brain dump there of stuff.
No, I have similar concerns because when this topic comes up, and inevitably it does, it's typically seen as a measurement. And then the first question that I get is, well, how do we know when we're shu? How do we know when we're ha? And how do we know when we're ri? And that's, there's not a checklist. There's not this. I wish there was a progression, like a test that we could do, like in the dojo, where, well, if you can do these four stances and these two kicks and these three punches and break five boards, you become a yellow belt, but it's not, it just doesn't work that way. So I always get a little nervous when they start looking for the measurement. But you're right. From a learning pattern and perspective, it's interesting to set that kind of expectation. But it's also a mindset measurement, which is also equally kind of troubling at times. It's, then it leads into, are you doing agile or are you being agile? Which is a conversation that most of the time I feel my soul dying a little bit when people start that up. It's one of those where, you have to do it before you can be it. So stop hurting the people that are doing it. Of those things. But with Shuhari, aside from the questions around how do you know, I also get concerned very few teams ever get to re, and very few teams maintain that for any extended period of time, which means it may not be the goal. I just question it. I wonder if teams get to the ha level and they're delivering frequently, the customer's delighted, what's the incentive to go forward?
Another issue with this concept is that, if you're talking about shu ha ri in terms of, say, learning taekwondo, what the end goal is in terms of the fact that you're learning taekwondo. But when we talk about shu ha ri in a sort of agile context, it's got to apply to a particular skill. And agile and scrum and all the things around it aren't one particular skill that we're learning. It's a massive body of knowledge and, mindset and opinion and all of these other things. So, I think often, I don't think we're being particularly explicit about what it is that we are going through these stages in. You've got to be at shu level in something, the prerequisites are, A, you've got to know what that thing is that you are shu in, and B, that you've got to actually want to be shu in that thing and want to, actually go through these stages of learning in that thing. And, in the context, again, of software development, I just don't see teams sitting there going, okay, we're at shu level scrum and we're going to learn this and then with the goal of becoming ra and then ha, and it just seems a bit of a fake construct to apply on top of software development teams, when actually, like you said, the goal is that we're delivering quality software to our customers. And I don't know if you can necessarily go through stages of learning for that. You just figure out what you're trying to achieve, and inspect and adapt your way to it.
I always come back to the concept of alignment, and this is what's been really eating at my brain lately, especially for the past couple months here where I've been off the air. But when you're talking about shu ha ri, I think the skill, if we had to pin down a skill, perhaps it is really the ability to create and maintain alignment. If you do that, and what I mean is, are the team members aligned as a functioning unit? And then are they aligned to the customer's needs, desires, goals? And then is delivering those outcomes that are being desired, Do we have the technology stack that's aligned to that? Do we have continuous integration? Do we have the continuous deployment? Do we have testing in place so that we can make changes safely? And so I keep coming back to the idea that if we can align all of these stars and get them all in the right order and space, this all becomes simple. So I wonder if that's the skill, creating and maintaining alignment.
Yeah. Oh, look, it's definitely, you know, as we all know, it's hugely important to, you know, being able to play as a team and be effective, you know, in an organizational context and what have you. But again, I maybe I just haven't got particularly well-formed thoughts on this, but I just, you know, again, think of, you know, for example, you know, someone like Lionel Messi, you know, the best football or soccer player in the world. And at the end of the day, you know, he's going to go through games and weeks and training sessions where he's doing the basics. He's, you know, they're going, you know, going over the just the basics of passing to each other and shooting, and it's not like he's reached some level where he's now just, he can float around and he's got nothing more to learn. I think there's, and maybe it's something to do with complexity here, but, you know, I feel like there's never any end point of learning or improvement or anything like that. Wherever we get to, we're always looking at the next thing that we need to learn or improve at. And there's no end goal to that. So that's probably why, you know, I kind of struggle a little bit with the Shuhari concept when applied to software development, because it just doesn't feel like there is some end state that we're aiming for. We're in too much of a changing dynamic environment, you know, with individuals changing in the teams, with the system around our teams changing constantly. It feels like we'd be resetting all the time if we were trying to, you know, sort of deliberately go through stages of learning. I guess it's an interesting one because it's just not something I really think about when I'm coaching or I suppose when I'm in a team doing, you know, working in any sort of capacity on product development. I guess it's just not something that goes through my mind. It only ever goes through my mind when I see someone tweeting or blogging about it and talking about it as a thing within Agile. And I don't know. I worry sometimes that, you know, I've seen at conferences, you know, and you get new people to Agile come along. You know, they've obviously been sent by their bosses to learn more about Agile and so they can bring it back into their organization. And they show up to some sessions and they start hearing about these concepts and you know, you can kind of almost see them shaking their head going, what the hell is this? You know, like I want to be learning about, you know, Agile software development techniques, not about, you know, martial arts kind of learning concepts. I feel like sometimes we get a bit too flowery and wishy-washy in the stuff that we talk about at conferences, about the fact that we're actually trying the people who aren't familiar with these things and, you know, give them a path in, you know, into it. And I think these kind of things can often put people off what we're trying to help them with.
So the conference scene is interesting because it typically is full of people who are newer to Agile. They've been sent there to learn. We start with these flowery concepts in these talks.
Yeah.
And just get totally bad ideas. and it was interesting because, you know, I was recently down in Orlando at one of the TechWell conferences, and they're actually very good about getting beginner track activities in place and making sure there's a really good mix. I think Lee Copeland puts together a really great program every year. And I had just given a talk. I went over and saw David Bernstein. Now, David wrote Beyond Legacy Code, a fabulous book, very much about XP practices, coding practices, how to be an Agile developer. And not a lot of people attended that talk. And it was one of the best of the conference. And I'm sitting there looking, you know, people are getting trapped into these more flowery talks. But here's a guy talking about 9 critical skills for an Agile developer and couldn't get more than 20 or 30 people in the room. And I thought it was such a shame that one of these flowery talks probably pulled people from, you know, one of the most important discussions that happened that weekend.
Absolutely. And I was actually thinking earlier about the irony of how much time we've invested in talking about No Estimates, for example. You know, one of the key arguments from, you know, certain people in No Estimates is about, you know, obviously reducing or eliminating estimation because it's a waste of time. And yet we invest so much time in talking about eliminating estimates. It's kind of ironic. you know, I always try and look for ways that how we can sort of demonstrate the drive meeting organizational goals and being effective is what's driving us. I've got to be showing that, you know, the people, the, you know, executives, senior managers, I've got to be showing them that my goal is to drive effectiveness in terms of, you know, how do we get better at meeting the organization's goals, rather than my goal is to evangelize, you know, agile and particular ways of working and organizing teams and what have you.
I'm typically in your camp with, this is a cute idea. It probably makes for a good 60-minute talk, and some people can probably sell some workshops with it. But is it actually actionable? And are my stakeholders going to pay for such concepts? And the answer is probably no.
Mm.
So, and that's the hardest part for people, I think.
You know, interestingly, though, you know, when we talk about people following the Scrum Guide, and this is just purely from my own experience, but I've actually never, ever worked with a team or come across a team that follows the Scrum Guide in my entire career. But I hear a lot of people talking about teams that are just blindly following the Scrum Guide. So they must exist, but it's just interesting that, you know, I've been, look, admittedly, I'm actually fairly new to the Agile scene. I mean, you know, Agile Scrum team since about 2008. So, you know, pretty new to the game, I suppose. But I've just never come across it. In fact, it's the opposite. I find that teams and organizations ignore the Scrum Guide and therefore aren't actually doing anything close to Scrum. So it's interesting to hear that people talk about teams following the rules, because I ritually see teams not wanting to follow rules and actually, you know, saying the opposite, saying we don't want to do Scrum because there's too much planning and, you know, there's too much sort of, I suppose, process in it, and we want to just focus on, you know, delivering software. And, you know, it's kind of like an abandonment of rules rather than a following of them. I don't know what your experience.
No, I would love to find a team that just followed the rules for a while and got some experience in working in such a way and forward. So I agree with you. It's typically an interesting experience I had as a younger Scrum Master. You know, at one point I reached a level of frustration with the Scrum team, and I finally said, look, raise your hand if you've actually read the Scrum Guide. And out of an 8-person team, 2 people raised their hands, and I was one of them. And so you're watching this play out, and it's like, come on, guys, we've got to at least read the document. And so I think it's a thing. But I think it's also important to remember our stakeholders. They're not paying for us to do Scrum. They're not paying for our stand up. They don't care about our retro. You know, and so those are never the goals. Like as an agile coach, as a practitioner, I need to become very good at those things and at facilitating and conducting them. But our stakeholders not paying for that. And it's always delivery centric. And I wonder, have you seen where teams get so caught up in the practices or the ceremonies or story points or whatever that they forget about the fact that the only thing that matters is really delivering the value back to the people paying the bills?
I have seen that. And, you know, often it stems from teams in situations where they've kind of been coerced into working in a Scrum-like way. You know, and actually to that point, like, you know, thinking about, can I actually think of any teams that just follow the Scrum Guide, like willingly? I'm just trying to think of teams that have actually willingly said, we want to do Scrum. Again, it's, you know, the situations we typically end up in are situations where we've been hired as a scrum master. So the decision's already been made to do scrum, and most likely the decision wasn't the team's, it was, you know, their bosses, in the organization. So, if you really think about it, I think the major problem we have is that teams aren't actually willingly choosing how they work. They're kind of being told to work agile or work scrum, and then then given these kind of delivery pressures within that, but then also expected to sort of, you know, improve their performance within that. But because they haven't willingly taken on that, that way of working, then they're not going to be inspecting and adapting, and, you know, because it's not something they've actually explored and said, hey, this is how we want to work, you know, this is how we want to deliver our deliver the software we're being asked to deliver. They're just doing it. So I think of all of these things, about, you know, we talk about the goals of a team and you know, how to get better and high performance and what have you, but if the starting point is not one of willingly partaking in a particular way of working, I don't think we can expect, you know, any kind of improvement in the team.
So there are ways that we can actually get there, though, and one of them, I know that team agreements and working agreements are a great way to get started. It can help set the stage. But what I have found is an area of compromise is actually the definition of done. And I don't know if you've used this tool to kind of get buy-in, but I think it's a wonderful practice. Well, first of all, I mean, if you're doing Agile and you don't have a definition of done, I'm a little bit worried. But I think that's an area where teams have made compromises where they've kind of adjusted to the being voluntold that they're doing Agile, not volunteering. Just an area where they can kind of put their stamp on it. How have you used the definition of done to kind of bring teams around and to perhaps get them back on the proverbial Agile bus?
So it's interesting you mentioned there about definition of done, and, you know, if you're Agile, you're not doing definition of done, you're worried. Because I think it's one of those topics that does have its opinions around it. So obviously it comes from Scrum in particular, around having, and it's all based around, you know, again, very solid principles of having a shared understanding, not just within the team, but within the wider sort of business group as well, about, for a particular piece of, for every piece of software that we're building, what does done look like in terms of our, environment, where this software ends up in terms of, you know, deployment, and what, you know, what functionality we're expecting, you know, has this software met the, you know, acceptance criteria? So does it actually do what the customer or the stakeholder expects it to do? You know, these are all solid, solid reasons to have a definition of done. But there was an interesting, and I've used, you know, when I've worked with teams as a scrum master, you know, it's something that we really talk about, because obviously we want to find ourselves in a position of momentum where we're actually able to deliver things and then move on and get that feeling of that we're actually, you know, delivering something useful and moving forward rather than sort of just keep working on something which can attract more scope to it and delay the actual, you know, delivery of that piece of software. So it's a useful tool, but, you know, someone tweeted the other day about that it's, you know, and I've seen a few tweets over the years about this, you know, people use the argument that, you know, software is never really done. And so to use I suppose they see that being abused in terms of, you know, it's a way of you know, getting people to just get stuff done rather than to actually think about what it is we're building and the value of what it is we're building. I sort of had a bit of back and forth on this, and you know, I said, well, I think when we talk, you know, in the definition of done, when we talk about done, I think what we really mean is good enough for now. So we kind of know that, you know, when we're doing agile and iterative software development, that we're actually willingly saying that we are going, we're willing to actually go back to that same piece of code, that same feature, and to iterate over that feature. So we don't actually mean it's done, as in we're never going to touch it again. We mean it's good enough for now to call that to call that progress, and that we can move on. And I kind of like that. I use one of my poor analogies that got shot down after I used it, but I still think it's kind of okay. That we, you know, I said it's kind of like chores, where like household chores, where we you know, I say the van, but knowing that, you know, in a couple of days' time, I'm going to have to do it again, right? It's never actually really done. It's good. I've done enough for now. It's good enough for now. I've made progress. I've cleaned up what I need to clean up for now. I can now move on to, you know, unloading the dishwasher and, you know, washing the windows. But yeah, so it's, again, it's one of those, it's what useful practices that probably gets abused in places, and people don't really understand what it means. And therefore it causes controversy and is often deemed as another way, you know, another form of coercion, I suppose.
Which is really unfortunate, because this is a tool that was designed to create transparency. Mm. So it was really, at least in my readings and in my experience, it's a tool that the team uses to communicate back to their product owner, their stakeholder, the person writing the check, what exactly working software means. And so what we're saying is, well, this code is unit tested, and we have behavior-driven testing behind it, and we've used standard coding practices, and we've used these libraries, and we've, you know, all these things are present so that when a stakeholder looks at a working piece of software, they know the assumptions behind it. And I've always thought that was an interesting, you know, because we've all been in the demo where there's a person sitting back in the office making data move, and then it shows up on the screen and it looks like the vaporware is real. But it really, in reality, the demo was a fraud, and you know, the stakeholders are duped, and checks are signed, and things move on. And you know, I can remember early in my career situations like that. The definition of done, I felt like, was designed to work against that, just to say, look, this is what it means when we show you software. So to hear teams are being abused by that, really disheartening.
Well, just to be clear, this is something that I've never really seen definition of done as a negative in my experience, but it is something that people do every now and then. It pops up in my feed that there's some, you know, kind of, I don't know, some controversy about definition of done, that, you know, that we should abandon it. You know, it's a unnecessary stage gate, or it's it perpetuates this notion of software being done when it isn't actually done, you know. And I suppose if I'm to put my sort of devil's advocate hat on, and you know, I think about how we typically end up using agile in, you know, I suppose organizations that haven't necessarily grasped agility, and you know, the reason for doing agile, we are able to you know, use empirical process, because we are, because we're building quality into our software and we're delivering these increments of working software, we say, well, you know, this is our progress in terms of what's done, and therefore we can kind of project that forward to, you know, talk about, you know, what that means in terms of the overall goal or objective of what we're trying to deliver. So, you know, done is that increment of progress towards that. But if you actually think about that, you know, and I spoke about this a few years ago when I was doing my whole no estimates roadshow, in that I find that we can use agile very effectively for, you know, empirically measuring progress towards our goals. Henrik Nyberg describes this beautifully in his product owner in a nutshell video, where he talks about, you know, if we've got a fixed scope variable cost, variable time question, or a fixed time variable scope question, and you can kind of draw these lines on your burn-up chart, and you can answer the question based on what's being asked using this projection of doneness. For me, I still think that's not really getting the essence of agile and agility. It's still, I still think it's just a slightly better way of managing a project rather than it being embracing agile for what it actually is, which is really about emergence and surprising outcomes. And we still kind of use these things to gain a sense of predictability and certainty around what we're doing rather than really embracing the uncertainty. So to call something done, it's almost like we're admitting that we're putting boundaries around what we think is done so that we can measure progress towards bigger outcomes of done. So I can kind of empathize a bit with the argument, because it does kind of, it's these little language things that we use in agile software development. A lot of them seem to contradict the whole essence of what agile is supposed to be. Right from the start, we say, because products are never really done, this is why we actually should embrace an agile way of doing things, because, and then just keep building the best possible outcomes and keep delivering value until there's something more valuable to move on to. So that whole concept removes the idea of done. We're done is when we don't know when we're going to be done. We're done when enough value is being delivered and there's some higher value opportunity has come along.
I think a lot of the things that appear in the typical definition of done could get moved over to a very basic working agreement, and a lot of the confusion would just dissipate.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm a big fan of that. The idea that we're done, because I liken software development back to craftsmanship, not really a science. And so if you ask an artist when their painting's done, it's, well, never really done. Or ask George Lucas, you know, the new Star Wars movie is coming out this weekend here in the U.S. And you ask Lucas or a director, you know, when are the films done? And, well, never. But they've got to get them out the door at some point. And so there's less value in continuing to work on it than there is getting those ticket sales, so they move forward. And even George Lucas went back and toyed around with my childhood and the Star Wars movies 3 or 4 times. So you're never done. It's just like you said, the value isn't, you know, good friend of the show, Tim Oniger, I think likes to say, was the juice worth the squeeze? And at some point the juice isn't worth the squeeze and you move on to the next thing. And I think he's a big fan of oranges. So that's how that works. But, you know, that's done for now.
Yeah.
And we move to the next thing, but someday perhaps we come back. But, you know, that, it's interesting that those things pop up in your feed. One thing that I'm sure pops up in your feed all the time, and you mentioned it, so it's fair game, is no estimates. And I know that, you know, between you and Woody and Vasco, you know, you guys are considered the big three. But I've always wanted to ask you this, and if this question is a little too direct, I apologize. But if you could do it all over again, would you stay out of the no estimates conversation?
No. because I suppose the stuff that I went through in terms of my thought process of learning about different ways of thinking about estimation, and then starting to blog about my thoughts on, hey, should we even be estimating software projects? I think my first blog post was called exactly that. Should we estimate software projects at all? And it was really a dump of my thoughts, you know, given that I'd now really begin to understand and embrace what agile really means. And then when you start to grok agile, you then start to question some of the, I suppose, the practices and you know, things that go on around that that don't seem to necessarily fit in with that way of working. So going through that thought process and then really starting to form some ideas around that and blogging about it and having great conversations and learning so much from people on both sides. I learned a lot of stuff from Glenn Allerman, who's, you know, one of the main critics of the, you know, the no estimates hashtag and stuff that's been going on, I suppose, under that name over the years. there were some, you know, frosty engagements within that. There was a lot of good stuff as well, but from both sides. You know, he asked me to share a lot of my stuff with him, and I, you know, I read a lot of his stuff, and, you know, found some kind of middle ground and learning, even though it doesn't seem that way on Twitter. There was, you know, outside of that, a lot of sort of mutual, I suppose, respect and learning. There was two or three bad things that went on, and to be honest with you, there was one point where I just got out of there completely, because it was just beginning to drain my time and energy, and nowadays I actually stay pretty clear of it. I dip in every now and then, and it's quite entertaining to have a read of what's going on in there, and I'll occasionally reply to one of the tweets, or I'll put the hashtag on one of mine, but I'm definitely not really very active in there anymore. But no, look, I'm not really the kind of person who have regrets about anything, to be honest. I think everything is a learning experience, and I still get dubbed the no estimates guy, and, you know, which can be problematic, particularly when you're sort of applying for head of engineering roles in companies, and, you know, you're speaking to execs and they're asking you about this stuff, and you're trying to sort of say, look, I didn't really mean that. There have been, I suppose, negative sides to it, but I think overall it's been a very positive thing for my career, and I'm happy that, you know, I hear countless stories of teams and individuals around the world that have benefited from stuff that I've written, and they're applying it in their day-to-day, and it's helped them improve the way they work, and it's all positive from my point of view.
That's a great way to look at it, in that it was really the journey, not the end result.
Yeah.
You know, it put you on this path, and you learned a lot. And I think the no estimates discussion, you know, even if you come out of it saying, well, it's all estimation and so we're still going to estimate and it's all nonsense, that's fine. But it forces you to question commonly held viewpoints, practices. And I think if you really take a hard look at the topic and the arguments, first of all, you do gain a lot of respect for people like Glenn. He is a giant in the estimation field.
Yeah,
and the work he does, I'm not nearly smart enough to follow many of the statistical models and the math that he applies to projects. And
yeah,
you know, but he does it very well, and so you learn a lot from there. The things that I could grok, I definitely pulled in and have used in certain places. But I've also been able to learn just what that next step along the Agile path, right? That, you know, it's not just a Scrum process. It's there's things here that these ideas are bigger than any one process or framework. And I think having these discussions and entertaining these ideas help us get further along. I mean, you know, look at Woody Zuhl and his Agile axioms and the things that have come out of, you know, his no estimates talks, his mob programming practices.
Yeah.
You know, these are bigger ideas. These are next level ideas. And I think all of these conversations lead up to that. You know, even Vasco, his book, his work, you don't have to agree with all of it, but if you can pull out a single idea and it leads to you having a little more insight into what it means to deliver software,
yep.
I think that's valuable.
Absolutely. I think one of the big curly issues around this no estimates conversation, and why I kind of, I suppose, got quite interested in it in the beginning, is, you know, I've kind of said from the start, it's not really that much in my, like, funnily enough, it's not really that much about estimation in terms of why I'm interested in the conversation. It's more about the dysfunctional behaviors that surround the practice of estimation. So being careful here not to say that they're caused by estimation, but when we in our teams and in our organizations, we, you know, when we sort of embark on this, there's this new thing that it's a new idea that we want to get off the ground. You know, the first question is, right, let's put some estimates around this baby. It's like suddenly everyone goes into high alert mode. So like, this, you know, the stakeholders are going into the mode of, you know, let's see how high this estimate's going to come out of, because if it's too high, then it's not going to be a viable project. And then the developers are going, right, we've shot ourselves in the foot so many times, I've got to make sure that I don't give too low an estimate in case the stakeholder goes, oh yeah, that sounds perfect. And then that gets locked in and I end up now in a situation where I'm held to what I say. So this kind of, these weird mind games go on, and the result of that is actually not good outcomes on either side. You know, the dates or the estimates that people are going to come out with are going to be not actually representing the reality of what they really think, because of the culture that are in. And it's all very well to say, well, this is bad management, or it's, you know, in the culture, a bad culture or whatever. But the thing is, it is a prevailing problem. Every organization I've worked in, I would say every single organization I've worked in has some weirdness going on around the whole estimation thing. And it's a game. And I think a lot of it is around the people at the top of companies. They are there for a reason, and they're there because they like making decisions and they like having a certain element of control. They have very strong opinions about what is right and what is wrong. When we talk about a healthy estimation environment where people are kind of collaborating and, you know, calling out assumptions and then, you know, revisiting those regularly, I just don't see that happening anywhere. What I see is a very much kind of, it's a request response situation. Someone is going to request an estimate, a response comes back, and that information will be taken away and used in whatever way that requester needs to use it. There is no revisiting and realigning and these other things. Just doesn't happen. If it did happen, fantastic. When I try and help teams with this, ironically, I spend a lot of my time helping teams get better at estimation, meaning not getting more accurate with it, but being able to provide estimates that are, you know, that have assumptions built in and uncertainty built in, and making them more collaborative and understanding the background to the request and all these kind of things. If you're doing all of those things, then, you know, it's healthy and harmless and actually probably useful. The problem is there is a dysfunction around, you could call it bad, and Glenn calls it bad management. He calls it the root cause of all of these problems are bad management. And my answer back was always, okay, but what can we do with that? Like, what's the next step? If the root cause is bad management, what do we do now? But we can't just tell people, here is how you get better at estimating, go off and kind of learn that and do it. We've got to actually address it. You know, you can only influence what you can influence. So in terms of like software development teams, how do they influence the situation for the better? And this is what I try and do, is try and help the teams when they do get asked for estimates, help them provide something that more meaningful, and also help the requester understand the problems underlying what normally happens with estimation, and trying to get them to frame the value and the impact and the impact of not doing this work and all of this information that would not normally be revealed to the lowly developers. But actually, by revealing that stuff, it helps everyone make better decisions. So that dysfunction, you know, this kind of whole area dysfunction exists, and this is why the conversation is still, in my mind, this is why it's still raging and why it's still so relevant and important. I don't think it will really ever go away. And I say it was never really about not estimating, to be quite honest. I know that, you know, Woody's angle is very much about that, and Vasco's angle is more about forecasting rather than doing estimation rituals. But really, again, it's not really about either of those things. It's more about the environment, the trust, the dysfunction, the inability to deliver what the business wants in a quick enough way. Now that they've had a taste of Agile and they've had a taste of thing, you know, features getting delivered every fortnight, they now want more, because the people who run our companies are always going to want more. We're never going to hit a point where they say, right, guys, you guys have been awesome this year. You're as pretty much high performing as we could ever wish to have. Just keep on going next year. That just will never happen. There will always be a push for more. That will always be interpreted as we need to get more stuff out the door, and we need to trim down our estimates so that we can hit our targets. And I called it a vicious cycle of distrust, I think, back when, you know, when I talked about this a few years ago.
I think that is a beautiful framing of the topic, and I really appreciate you doing that. I think that's one of the better explanations I've heard in a long time around what no estimates is to you, what it has meant to others, and how it can benefit people, even if you end up disagreeing. And so I really appreciate you doing that. Maybe with these last few minutes, if you just want to wrap up, if there's anything you've got going on, anything like you'd like to plug, website, blog site, Twitter feed, let's get that out there, because I think people are very interested in the perspective that you bring. Again, agilist, big idea guy, management, you know, all of these things coming together, it is a unique blend. And I think it makes your blog and your Twitter feed very interesting at times. And so I'm sure people would love to follow you. If you can give them ways they can follow you or reach out, I think they would very much appreciate it.
Yeah, sure. Twitter is a good place to get me, at Neil_Killick. I do have a blog, neilkillick.com. To be honest, I haven't actually written a post for a while, which is pretty bad. I probably need to make a New Year's resolution to start getting in the flow of that again, because I really do enjoy it. But look, it's hopefully there's some good stuff on there to that discusses a lot of the topics that we've been discussing today. But yeah, those are the best ways to reach out to me.
You know, there's a number of blog posts that you've done that have had a great influence on me. I'll pick out two or three of my favorites, get them in the show notes to give people a place to start with you.
But, yeah, sure.
I do highly recommend Neil's blog. It is, you don't have to. Here's the thing that, here's what it is, Neil, and I wonder if you agree with this. There is this concept out there of winning and losing when it comes to ideas. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe ideas are zero sum because they're infinite.
Yep.
You can have a new idea every moment. It's okay for many of them. In fact, most of mine are wrong. But when I do hit on a good one, I try to run with it. But just enjoy the ideas.
Yeah.
Even if you disagree with it, take something from it. Even if it's a corollary idea, or if it's an anti-pattern, whatever it is. Take that inward, internalize it, make it part of your agile theory, and move forward. And I think that's a way to do it.
Absolutely, and I would add to that as well that we should apply the scientific method to this as well. So if you don't agree with an idea, rather than just reject it, actually test it. Actually gather your own data and experiment with it. And I know, again, for some reason, the No Estimates advocates like recoil at the idea of people experimenting with this stuff. But actually, the way I got into the No Estimates thing in the first place, I actually used to argue with Vasco about this. And I would actually say, how can you ditch story point estimates? We need them at the, for the bigger chunks of work. It doesn't make sense to just say count stories, because what about the bigger scale parts of the backlog, and I guess like what you'd now call a critic, No Estimates critic. But what I did was I listened to what Vasco had to say, and then it was very easy to run a safe to fail experiment, because the project I was happened to be managing at the time using story point estimates. So all I started doing was starting to measure the story count as well, which I just previously wasn't doing. What I'll do is I'll start measuring this, and I'll see if what Vasco is saying has any kind of legs and, in our context. And, after about 3 or 4 months of data gathering and, realizing that he was spot on, that actually count of the stories was providing us with, actually better accuracy for forecasting. And it was just following the same pattern trend as the story points, The team were in the mode of just pretty much everything was a three because you're breaking stuff down as a team naturally, because you work in 2 week iterations. Everything kind of tends to average out in terms of size. Law of averages and law of large numbers kicks in, so it becomes less about the individual items and more about the collection of items and the trends. And I actually, I distinctly remember, I actually then went back to Vasco and I simply tweeted, "You were right." That was really what then triggered my interest in exploring it further. And then I somehow became one of the big three, as you introduced me earlier, of no estimates. So yeah, it's an interesting journey. But I suppose the message there is that I didn't just dogmatically have an idea and then just stick with it and run with it. I actually tested other people's ideas and then listened to all sides of the argument. And then my opinions have definitely fine tuned over the years as well. I wrote a post on the Scaled Agile Framework a few years ago called The Horror of the Scaled Agile Framework, and it was a real kind of rant piece at the time. But again, since then my views have changed, and to be honest with you, it's kind of like with code. If you look back on your code from a couple of years ago and you're happy with it, there's something wrong. It means you haven't moved on, you haven't learned. And I often read my older blog posts, and a lot of my old self I still agree with, but then there's other things that I've sort of learned more about and moved on with. So I think that for me is what the essence of it's what it is all about. And like you say, if people are rejecting ideas and they just want to win the argument, then we're not really applying, which we're uncovering better ways of working. You know, we're not applying that to our own ideas and our own mental models. And I always try and challenge my mental models and see which things I really, really genuinely do believe are principles that are embedded in me, and other things which are things I need to have open to scrutiny. You can only really do that by putting out those ideas and testing the boundaries and, you know, sometimes you put the extreme side out just to see if there's enough, you know, if people can come back with a good argument as to why that case is wrong, then you can then start to sort of reform and learn from that. If there is no good comeback to that, then you go, well, maybe I'm onto something here. Maybe we do need to get extreme with this. So yeah, it's good to read as many opinions as you can. And interestingly, if you find yourself disagreeing with something, that's where you need to probe further and try and learn more about it. If we just carry on reading the stuff we agree with, we're never going
to
grow.
Well, Neil, I can't think of a better way to end the show, so I think we'll end it here. I just want to thank you again for sharing your morning with us and for being here, for sharing these ideas and just all great stuff. And thanks for pulling me out of podcasting retirement. I wasn't sure when I was going to get to record next, but this is great. And I can't wait for the next time that we get to speak.
Was it like one of those movies where you've come out for just one last
week? No, we are back. So we are going to get back on a good schedule. Like we talked about, before the show,
yeah,
life has a way of taking over hobbies and the fun stuff. So,
well, just to close, I think you'd be doing a disservice to call this a hobby, because it really is a fantastic podcast. You know, I listen to only a handful of Agile podcasts, and this one is definitely the best. The content, the level of intelligence and the way that ideas are framed, the guests you have on the show, it's really a fantastic listen. So that's why I wanted to just be involved in it again. And so thank you for allowing me to do that.
Well, thank you, Neil. I appreciate those words. And the show's only great because people like you come on and join me. So I certainly appreciate that. And to all the listeners out there, thank you for being patient. Life certainly did jump in the way of this podcast for a few weeks, but we are back. We have many great guests like Neil lined up. We're going to have some really fun shows out there very soon. Thanks for listening, everybody, and have a great night.
Thanks for listening to Agile for Humans. Let's keep the conversation going. Drop us a question on Twitter @AgileForHumans or visit agileforhumans.com.